Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Monday's total solar eclipse will make a grand sweep across the United States. We know what's happening as the country falls into darkness under the shadow of the moon. But humans did not always know, and it was scary. Even as we learned, the eclipse inspired fear and awe, still can. This hour On Point, from ancient China to Homer and Shakespeare to right now, the power of the eclipse in history and myth. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you caught up in eclipse mania? Does your family, your culture, have its own eclipse story? Do you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, is Brooke Young, the town's official eclipse coordinator. Hopkinsville is along the path of the eclipse and will experience about 2 minutes, 40 seconds of what they're calling totality, that is, the complete blocking out of the sun around 1:25 p.m. Central Time on Monday. Brooke Young, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
Are you ready?
Oh, we are ready. The town is already buzzing. People, we had our first campers at our city campsite arrive at very, very early in the wee hours of the morning this morning. And so they are very excited, and the streets are beginning to fill up, and we're seeing a lot more traffic, and the restaurants are buzzing. So everyone is excited, and the community is just coming together and excited for what the weekend holds leading into Monday.
Now, I'm looking at this map of the eclipse as it sweeps across the United States from Oregon, right sort of in a big diagonal line right down to South Carolina. And this is the band where the eclipse will be most intense, where it will last the longest. And, of course, the further you get away from being precisely under that band, the less long it will last. And here's Hopkinsville. You're kind of right there between Paducah and Nashville in southwestern Kentucky. You are just about as smack dab on the center of this solar eclipse path as you could possibly be.
We sure are, and we are so fortunate. We like to consider this a gift from the universe. You know, this isn't something that we bid on, or an event that we put our name in the hat for. This is something that the universe selected Hopkinsville for. So we are designated as the point of greatest eclipse, which means we are the point where the moon's axis is closest to the Earth. So if you were to take a dowel rod and stick it through the sun, through the moon, and pinpoint a place on the Earth where all three of those line up most perfectly, it would be Hopkinsville, Kentucky. So people are coming from, currently we have people coming from 46 different states and 19 different countries to join us here in our town of about 32,000. Our county's about 70,000, but we'll more than double that population this weekend.
How are you expecting people to position themselves to watch it? Do you have an area or a field or a park, or are people just going to be plopped all over your streets and sidewalks? What's the plan?
All of the above. We actually have about 50 areas that we have recognized as public viewing areas. So all of those are taking pre-reservations, and people can reserve either designated size areas, or they can just come and it'll be per car and pull up into a field. We have a lot of farmland here in the community, so we're very fortunate. There's a lot of unobstructed views of the sky, so people will have a beautiful place to watch this event take place, and it's just going to be tremendous to see all of these folks roll into town. And we really are going to have them everywhere. You know, our public parks, our attractions, our farmland, any open parking lot, you know, our schools and our churches and all of these organizations that are also opening up and wanting to welcome all the folks to their organization.
Do you have gear on hand, the kit, the kind of eye protection that people need to watch the eclipse as it happens? Or do you expect them to bring their own? What's the deal there? Do you have merchants set up hawking the special glasses?
We do. We have, overall as a community, we ordered about 175,000 pairs of glasses in anticipation of the visitors coming in. So those are, I mean, they're selling like hotcakes. People are getting their hands on those as they roll into the community, but there are still plenty to go around here. And we have about 200 vendors that have pulled into the community and have those for sale as well. And additionally, food vendors. You know, we know our restaurants can't handle all of the additional visitors we have, so we've got about 100 additional additional food vendors that are set up throughout the community to accommodate all of the additional visitors. So we are ready for folks to head this way and can't wait to welcome them.
And all of this for how much time of eclipse in Hopkinsville?
2 minutes and 40 seconds. Actually, 2 minutes and 40.1 seconds. We don't want to forget that point one.
2 minutes and 40.1 seconds that have put little Hopkinsville, Kentucky on the map.
That is right.
Brooke Young is the eclipse coordinator for this town. And Brooke, we wish you very good luck as the sun blinks out, blacks out for 2 minutes and 40 seconds on Monday. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. We can't wait. Monday, here we come.
Good luck. We know what's coming. Humans did not always. And the kind of fear and quaking that could happen in the face of an eclipse has made it into the human record for a long, long time. Here's a scene from Homer's ancient epic poem from Greece, The Odyssey, read by British actor Ian McKellen. This is the soothsayer Theoclymenus delivering a speech that some scholars suggest was a poetic description of an eclipse and men's fear.
Poor man, what terror is this that overwhelms you so? Night shrouds your heads, your faces, down to your knees. Cries of mourning are bursting into fire, cheeks rivering tears, the walls and the handsome crossbeams dripping dank with blood. Ghosts, look, thronging the entrance, thronging the court, go trooping down to the realm of death and darkness. The sun is blotted out of the sky. Look there! A lethal mist spreads all across the earth.
And that from the time of Homer, we are talking about the total eclipse of the sun coming on Monday and how humans have looked upon it for eons now, how many still look upon it right now. You can join us at 800-423-8255. Two guests with me today who have thought a lot about the history of the lore of the eclipse and the allure of the eclipse right now. With us from Portland, Oregon, is John Dvorak. He is author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. He spent 20 years operating a big telescope at Mauna Kea for the University of Hawaii's Institute of Astronomy. Seen two solar eclipses already. On Monday, he'll be in Eastern Oregon on the Path of Totality. John Dvorak in Oregon, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, hi, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And also with us from the path that the eclipse will take on Monday is Frank Close. He joins us from Jackson, Wyoming. He's emeritus professor of physics at Oxford University. Monday will be his seventh solar eclipse. He'll be watching there from Jackson, also author of the book Eclipse Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon. Frank Close there in Jackson, Wyoming. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
John Dvorak, begin to take us back to how humans first responded to what we know has gone on for ever and ever, the blackout of the sun in eclipse. What's the earliest record that we have?
Well, the earliest record is in about 1275 BC in what is now Syria. And we know of a total eclipse that passed over there, at least the earliest written record. As we go back in oral tradition, those probably go back another 1,000 years or so. For example, there are several eclipses mentioned in the Bible. One in about 1533 that came over Abraham when he was in the land of Canaan.
So we've got, and the Chinese you write about as well, with records of eclipses there?
Oh, yes. And the records of China also go back to about the second millennium B.C.,
We're going way, way back with an allure and a fear, a terror straight up that humans felt. Frank, when did humans come to understand what was actually going on with the blacking out, the blocking out of the sun?
Well, that probably wasn't until much later. Almost maybe the Middle Ages. Because one of the things that probably will only become apparent when people see this thing is that during the whole of the partial eclipse phases, you never see the moon. You get the impression that the sun is literally being eaten away. And I think that was the reason why the ancients, a lot of them had these myths that some creature was eating the sun. Like the ancient Chinese, they liked the idea that a dragon was eating the sun. And so they would make a lot of noise. They would go outside banging drums to make as much noise as possible to scare the dragon away. And ironically, of course, it always worked, because the sun came back afterwards.
Yes, well done.
And at the end of the partial phases, then you have this very weird sensation in totality that where the sun should be, there's a black hole in the sky. It's like an eye peering down at you. So the in the reading that Ian McKellen gave just earlier, the idea of terror is very easy to understand. I mean, even today when we know fully what is happening here in the 21st century, I predict on Monday there will be people be totally overwhelmed by it, and people in tears. It's a remarkable emotional experience. So imagine what it was like thousands of years ago, and it must have been indeed terrifying. I've had the impression myself that you get the black hole in the sky with this shimmering light just around it, and then the heavens above you are dark. You can see some stars, and down towards the horizon it becomes a deep purple. There's a 360-degree sunset, because now you're looking out beyond the shadow of the moon. You have the impression that everything you take for granted, you know, heat, light, the source of life itself, has been sucked off into space. And that, I think, must have been indeed a terrifying experience for them. And so they would create these myths to try to make sense of it. But it wasn't until the Middle Ages, really, that the understanding of what was going on, that the fact that there was a pattern that these eclipses would repeat on regular cycles, that had been noticed, I think, John may be able to correct me here, but I think that would have been noticed probably way back in the years BC. Not so much for the sun, because with the solar eclipses, you have to be in the right place at the right time. That's why so many people are coming to this narrow belt in the USA next week.
Frank, hold the thought right there. We'll come back to you right away in Jackson, Wyoming. We have to take a short break here. A diamond ring flashes around a black hole in the sky, vibrant like a living thing. That's Frank Close's description from his book, Eclipse: Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon. John Dvorak is with us, author of Mask of the Sun. What will you be doing on Monday? Will you be chasing the solar eclipse? Can you imagine not understanding what was going on when the sun is blocked out? It's when the day met the night. Panic at the Disco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
In the middle of summer, always golden in the sky, always golden when the day met the night. In summer, always golden in the sky, always golden when the day met the night. Summer, summer, summer.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the total eclipse of the sun and how inhabitants of this planet have responded over eons across history and right now, Monday in the USA, when it will sweep from the northwest right across in kind of a big diagonal belt down to South Carolina, with that band of totality where the sun, as we've heard a lot now, will be completely blocked out by the shadow, by the moon, and the shadow of the moon will fall upon the earth. Frank Close is with us, Emeritus Professor of Physics from Oxford University, author of Eclipse: Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon. He has chased many solar eclipses. We'll be watching this one from where he joins us today, Jackson, Wyoming. John Dvorak joins us from Portland, Oregon, also right there in the band, author of Mask of the Sun: The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. You can join us as well. Will you be in the path of the total eclipse or near enough? And what will you be doing when the sun goes dark? What's your question on exactly how all this will happen on Monday? And what's your question on how humans have handled this before they understood it? Here's a little bit from Shakespeare, King Lear, Earl of Gloucester here, played by Richard Byers, describing the strange effect of eclipses in a 1994 BBC radio adaptation.
These late eclipses in the sun and moon portend no good to us. Though the wisdom of nature can reason it thus and thus, yet nature finds itself scourged by the sequent effects. Love cools. Friendship falls off. Brothers divide. In cities, mutinies. In countries, discord. In palaces, treason. And the bond cracked twixt son and father.
There, from Shakespeare's King Lear, John Dvorak, it's just a couple of minutes of darkness if you're right in the very center of it. You know, I mean, maybe I can understand why people freaked out when they had no idea what was going on. Today, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? I mean, it's the shadow of the moon falling on the earth. Okay.
Well, you're right. It's very straightforward. It's a natural phenomenon. But yet, having stood in the shadow of the moon, and even though I have a lot of background in physics and science and so forth, I still have this strange feeling inside of me that something is terribly wrong when I look up at this, at the total solar eclipse.
Take us back to some of the mythologies that, over time, different cultures used to explain what was happening, John.
Well, it really goes back to a prehistory, and as Frank mentioned, it was very common to think that something was eating at the sun. But, you know, most of these myths, we always think of them as childhood stories or fanciful, but myths are really about core beliefs. And so these stories usually have a deeper meaning. The sun and the moon in almost every culture are deities that are related, like a brother and sister. And so when you see them commingling in the sky, as we see it from Earth, that's a brother and sister, and that's incest, and that's a problem. And so that is at the basis of many of these myths. So something has gone wrong in the universe. And we have to reverse it. We have to repent. We have to have a ritual. And that's what people were doing.
Frank, what do you see the ancient stories to explain this? As you say, even before people understood exactly what was happening, there was recognition of a pattern here. It wasn't always just as if they were completely naive or hadn't heard that this does happen, did happen. What do you see in the stories they used to explain it?
Well, I think, as John said, the sun is the source of life, and in many cultures it was elevated to the level of a deity. And so if your god is suddenly disappearing, that is something that gives cause for concern. And I suppose myths are attempts to make comprehension of things that are incomprehensible. And that was, if you like, from our perspective, the best they could do.
Here's a little bit from the Cherokee tradition, the Native American tradition, which says the eclipse was caused by a giant frog eating the sun. Here's Mike Crow from the Museum of the Cherokee Indian in North Carolina describing that legend's significance to the tribe.
The frog would come up and he would swallow the sun. That kind of has a lot of associations with the frog itself, with the underworld and traveling between the worlds. And also connected with the balance that is a constant thing throughout our culture in many different forms and facets, the light and dark, for instance.
Right across time, John, you've looked at so many of these. I mean, you've got the incest of sun and moon. You've got also the portent of something terrible to come. Was that? I mean, you know, we know how natural phenomena work. We can always sort of explain human events with reference to them. We can impose stories around natural events. Have you seen that pattern through history?
Well, that's right. Almost every society, every culture, you look up in the sky and things are happening. The planets are moving. The sun and the moon are moving. And those have an influence as to what's happening down here. And so when this dramatic event happens, the sun goes out, that's going to have some bad omen for down here, like perhaps the death of a king, the beginning of a terrible disease will happen. And there are many examples of that in history.
I mean, you write, it almost seems as though back in the day, no one wanted to be born or to die without an eclipse coming nearby. It was also a signifier of the augustness or importance of their existence, that it was somehow related to an eclipse. You're going down here through, you know, with reports from Roman historian Tacitus on the death of Emperor Augustus. We're talking, you know, way back 1 month before a lunar eclipse, and that is noted as giving significance. Or what King Olaf killed in 1030. Norwegian king, 33 days later. They note in the sagas of the Norse kings that the day suddenly became dark as night. It seems as though John historians or myth makers reached for these associations to give significance to people of note.
Well, from our perspective, it's a reach. From their perspective, this is a cause and effect. For example, in a British history, King Henry I crosses the English Channel from England to France in 1133. And as he's crossing, the moon shadow passes over him. And that's pretty frightening. Something's going to bad happen to him, and it did. He never returned to England. And hundreds of years later, we have the War of the Roses, the Tudors, and the House of York. The man who will become Henry VII defeats Richard III. The mutilated body of Richard III is laid out intentionally for the bright light of a full moon to illuminate it. But there's a lunar eclipse that night.
Whoa.
And the body is always in darkness. And that is the clue. That is the end of the House of York.
Frank?
These eclipses, of course, you know, they're good news for one side and bad news for the other.
It
depends whether you're a cup half full or half empty person as to whether you decide the eclipse was a good thing or a bad thing. So when an eclipse happened, it was clearly going to be portentous. But whether it was going to be portentous for you or for them, it was only after the event you were able to predict it. And I think there's a great temptation even today, you know, to make correlations. I remember the very first lunar eclipse that I saw was in February 1971 in San Francisco, I was at the time. And that very same night, there was a major earthquake in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And, of course, people were then saying, was there a link between the eclipse and the earthquake? Well, no, because the conditions for an eclipse are almost met every month at new moon. And earthquakes happen very frequently.
Yep.
And by just chance, sometimes the two will happen together. But when they do, you remember them. Because if you're in an earthquake, you surely remember it. And if you're at a total eclipse, you surely remember it. And it's very tempting to put them together and think it's somehow significant.
It's amazing how tempting it is to reach out and use this. I mean, we've got some people right now, I think, in the U.S. who are like, okay, enough with the eclipse. On the other hand, your great Shakespeare there, Frank, he could never get enough of this. King Lear, we heard some of that. These late eclipses in the sun and the moon portend no good to us, the Earl of Gloucester and King Lear. In Antony and Cleopatra, here's Antony complaining, our terrene moon is now eclipsed, foretelling his fall. Othello decides that a huge eclipse of sun and moon would be a fitting accompaniment to the tragedy of Desdemona's death. Shakespeare can't get enough. In Hamlet, more Shakespeare, Horatio speaks of the several evil omens that foretold Caesar's death, refers to the moon as sick, almost to doomsday with eclipse. You bring us all that, John, but it's your Shakespeare just can't resist touching the eclipse, Frank. What do you think? I mean, he's a pretty creative, original playwright, and yet he keeps going back to this one.
Well, Shakespeare, yes, I think we probably all agree, is the greatest writer in the English language. And let me assure you that even his eloquence is not able to touch the absolute miracle that you're going to experience on Monday. It is beyond description. The reason I think, though, that King Lear in particular, maybe Shakespeare in general, was so fascinated was by total chance, he was alive at a very interesting period when, by coincidence, a series of eclipses of moon and or of the sun were visible in England, and in particular in Stratford, where he was. 1605, just before King Lear was completed, there was a total eclipse of the sun that Shakespeare would have seen, and that of itself would have been memorable. But in the 20 or 30 years before that, there had been a remarkable run of eclipses, which people would certainly have noticed, and in those days thought that something terrible was going to happen, you know. I mean, although it's the case that if you stand around and wait for an eclipse to happen, you'll have to wait 400 years on the average for a solar eclipse to happen in your backyard. Sometimes you're lucky and they happen within a few years.
William Shakespeare living in a string of eclipse action there. Frank Close, writes Eclipse, Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon, his wonderful book about his long pursuit of the eclipse phenomena, and John Dvorak, Mask of the Sun, the Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. Lots of callers for the two of you. Janice in Baltimore, in Maryland. Janice, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that August the 21st, 1914, there was an eclipse right after World War One began. And I also believe that there is another eclipse that is forecast for 2024. There are several statements in the Bible that talk about signs in the suns and the moon that have to that center around tribulation and difficult times coming. So I think that eclipses are definitely a sign from God in the heavens. I know everybody's not a Christian or everybody doesn't even believe in God, so I'm not trying to offend anyone, but from a biblical standpoint and even from things that we've seen in history, eclipses do definitely give us a sign of something. They are an omen of something that's happening.
But Janice,
heavens.
Let me ask you about that. How can it be a sign if we can already, now that we have very good, you know, astronomy skills, we can already... We can tell you every eclipse that's going to come, I suppose, from here for thousands of years. So they're already set more or less in stone in the path of the sun and the earth and the moon. How can there be a sign in there?
I don't think that it's necessarily a negation of man's intelligence. I think that God has allowed us to be very intelligent, and we figured these things out. But it doesn't. I still don't think that it means that he's not trying to give us messages. So I don't think that one voids out the other. I just think that men are extremely intelligent, and we're figuring out a lot, but God is still speaking to us.
Janice, I appreciate your call. Frank, human beings cannot resist assigning some greater meaning to this eclipse realm, I guess.
Well, let me just point out that actually eclipses that don't just happen once in a blue moon, to mix a few metaphors. There is an eclipse somewhere a couple of times a year, and there's a total eclipse somewhere every 18 months. So although in the United States this is the first one for a long time and there will not be another one until 2024, as your caller said, if you go to South America, there will be one in 2019, and go to the Pacific and have one the following year. So eclipses actually are happening quite regularly. It's just that you have to go to exotic places to meet them, and that's why this particular one is so special, because you can actually access it.
John, we can understand when people didn't know what was going on, why they would assign special meaning to it, even divine intervention or messaging to humans. But now that we know so well, I mean, you're an astronomer. We know exactly what's happening here, and yet the urge to assign meaning, greater meaning, it still seems to linger.
Well, yeah, yes, you're right. And it even happens in contemporary times. The example that I like to give out is in 2004 during the World Series. On the last game of the World Series, there was a total lunar eclipse. And you could see it from the baseball stadium in St. Louis. And in that game, St. Louis lost.
Red Sox versus Cards, yep, yep.
And the Boston Red Sox won. First time in over 80 years. And so if you lived in St. Louis, that total lunar eclipse, which ended just 10 minutes after the game, that was a bad omen. And in Boston, you either ignored it or you said, well, this was unusual and this was a good omen for us.
Yeah.
Well, I come from this rather quaint society in England, which plays a game called cricket.
Heard of it, yeah.
Maybe cricket can go on for several days.
Yes.
And there was one occasion in recorded history back in the 70s when a match was being played between England and India, and it's the only recorded occasion when eclipse stopped play is in the list.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Andrew in Lincoln, Nebraska. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. What I think is really interesting about this is that the idea of perspective. So perspective allows us this even to happen because of the way that the sun and the moon lined up and their relative size in the sky. And my hope would be that as people take this in, we get a little perspective and realize just how big the universe is and how small we are and ask a question. We don't know if life anywhere else in the universe exists. We know it exists here. And what unites us? We're all earthlings. We're all humans. And when we have a time of such great division, especially in this country,
mm-hmm.
I think that perspective and that meaning can be really useful.
And maybe strongly in Lincoln, Nebraska, you're right on the path of totality, as everybody loves to call it. Right, Andrew?
Absolutely. We're getting ready for a big celebration at the university, and we're happy to be in that path.
An incitement to the contemplative there, even to the cosmic, make us see our puny size and how we're all in this together, sort of hurtling through the universe. Andrew, I appreciate your call. Monday, it's coming, that path of totality sweeping right across the U.S. You can join us this hour. John Dvorak is here, author of Mask of the Sun. Frank Close is with us. He's in Jackson, Wyoming on that path. Eclipse, Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon. What do you think? Will you be in the path of the total eclipse? What will you be doing when the sun goes dark? What's your question on how humans handle this before they understood it? And can you picture what a cave dweller thought when the sun went away? 21 Pilots here with Hometown. I'm Tom Ashbrook, waiting for the eclipse. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the total eclipse of the sun and how inhabitants of this planet have responded over eons across history and right now, Monday, when it sweeps across the United States. Frank Close is with us, Emeritus Professor of Physics from Oxford University. He'll be watching in Jackson, Wyoming. He joins us from there today. His book describing his long pursuit of the eclipse phenom all over the world is Eclipse: Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon. Very vivid evocations of the eclipse experience. And John Dvorak is with us from Portland, Oregon, where it will also be very dark for that couple of minutes on Monday, author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. He worked that big telescope in Mauna Kea in Hawaii for about 20 years, knows something about what's going on up there. You can join us this hour. What's your favorite eclipse reference from history, mythology, story, song? Do you understand people who are obsessed with the eclipse? Do you have special eclipse stories passed down in your family, your culture? And have you felt the weird thrill when day turns to night? How into it are some people? Well, in June, KMTR Television in Eugene, Oregon, featured the home of John Brewster, an amateur astronomer in Oregon, who, after a 1979 solar eclipse there, told reporter Megan Shin he started thinking about building a house, his own for himself, complete with a small domed observatory along the path of totality for this coming eclipse on Monday, even though when he started building the house, it was nearly 40 years away.
We've been planning for all these years to be ready for the big, great American eclipse.
Since 1979, the couple has planned their lives.
We built the house here in order to be in line with the eclipse.
Around 2 minutes of totality.
All of this work for 2 minutes. I'm like, yes, of course. There's never a question.
Okay, and now at last it comes, and their house is all ready. Smiley in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Smiley, thanks to you. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How it goes, man? I'm from Jamaica, and I'm 64 years old, and I've been watching eclipse ever since. Hello?
Yes, we're right here, Smiley. And what okay, stories did you have about it in Jamaica as a kid? What did they tell you about it?
Okay, let me just quickly run this by you, and then I'll hang up and listen to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, they said that the sun and the moon have a fight, and if they... sun beat the moon, we live. But if the moon beat the sun, we are all going to die. And our parents let us know that it's got something to do with the people and the earth. That's one thing I believe. I would like the scientists to explain that for me. I know there's sometimes when you have a full moon, you got some people that get tearing crazy. And as soon as the moon is settled, they come back normal as normal without no medication, no nothing. So I'd like him to explain a little about that for me.
We've got it. Let me go first to the mythology, Smiley. I love your Jamaican story there. John Dvorak, what about this, the sun and moon in a battle in an eclipse? Do you see that as a story that's repeated over time?
Occasionally, but most of the part, the majority of the time, it's really a... commingling of the two of them together. It's not a violent thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's something which we are supposed to reject up there.
Back to your incest reference earlier, that people thought, oh, no, these two don't belong together. They shouldn't overlap.
That's right.
And Frank, what about Smiley's question on emotional responses to an event like this? He's thinking of just a full moon, let alone a full solar eclipse. I mean, you've seen so many. Do you see something that it pulls out of people that they might not expect in terms of emotion or behavior?
Oh, it is certainly highly emotional. You'll see fully grown adults probably in tears afterwards. The nearest analogy I have is if you've been present at the birth of a child, that intellectually, just before the child is born, you know it is in there, and you think you're prepared for the birth, and then a moment later the child is there, a living thing, and it's an overwhelming experience. And in that moment where the last sliver of the sun has disappeared and you sort of intellectually know that the moon is doing the job, suddenly the silhouette of the moon appears like a conjuring trick out of nowhere. It is truly overwhelming. And animals, of course, think it's nighttime. The animals around you go to sleep, but the humans are very interesting. I would recommend people make an audio recording and play it back afterwards and see the reactions of people.
Just have a listen. John, you note that the eclipses have played a role in the lives of any number of famous individuals. Alexander the Great, Nat Turner, Lawrence of Arabia, Albert Einstein. What in each of those? What was it with Alexander the Great?
Well, with Alexander the Great, had just come back from India, and he was trying to get back in the palace, but the priest wouldn't let him because there were eclipses coming. There was going to be an eclipse. And when he finally did get back in, he saw there was somebody else sitting on the throne. And a few days later, this man was executed. And this was a ritual that was done during the time of Alexander. It was known as the substitute king ritual. If something bad was going to happen in the sky, like an eclipse, the king was taken off the throne and was put in hiding. You grabbed an enemy or a commoner, and they took on all the trappings of the king. They slept in the bedchamber. They ate the same food. They did the rituals. And when the possibility of an eclipse passed, that person was executed and the king was brought back. It was a way of protecting the king.
What about Nat Turner, the slave Nat Turner, famous from the rebellion back in the 1830s?
Oh, that's right. There's an eclipse in 1831. And Nat Turner is a slave, and he looks up in the sky, and he has this a vision as a result of an eclipse, that it's time for the slaves in the United States to rise up and rebel. And that's what he did a few months later.
Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, the British military officer.
Right, Lawrence of Arabia. It's 1917, the First World War. Lawrence and the Arabs are fighting the Turks, and they would like to take the city of Aqaba. Now, Aqaba is a seaport, and it defends itself from an assault on the sea, and it's essentially impossible to take the city. But the desert side is unprotected. And so Lawrence, along with the Arabs, if you remember in that famous movie, they crossed the Sinai Desert. That's exactly what they did. And Lawrence had an almanac, and he knew that there was going to be a full moon, and there would be a total lunar eclipse, so it would be dark. And he understood that when that happened, the Turks were going to shoot off their guns and have a celebration, and that's when he stormed Aqaba, and he took over the city.
A pretty good cover, that. Albert Einstein, what's his eclipse story?
Oh, Einstein. To me, the most important eclipse in history is May of 1919, and it's important for two reasons. One reason many people know, the other not too many people know. Now, 1919, we'll step back. We'll step back to 1915, Albert Einstein. His general theory of relativity, he makes this totally outlandish prediction that starlight does not follow a straight line. It gets bent if it goes through a massive body. And he predicts when you might be able to measure this. During a total solar eclipse, you can see stars. And the position of stars will have shifted because the starlight passes very near the surface of the sun. Mm-hmm. 1919, there's a total solar eclipse. It goes from Brazil across the Atlantic to Africa, Photographs are taken, and he's right. And literally overnight, Albert Einstein becomes a world celebrity. What most people don't understand or don't realize, it has another big impact. There was a philosopher of science. His name was Karl Popper. Mm. He didn't understand much about Einstein and the theory of relativity, but he was always puzzled by how do you tell the difference between science and non-science? And he came to the conclusion, it's not doing experiments and confirming things. He said astrologers are doing that all the time. It's being able to falsify. And what Albert Einstein had done is made a prediction. If the prediction was wrong, his theory would have been falsified. He said that is what science is all about. And so our whole nature of scientific truth changed because of that total solar eclipse.
Subjected Einstein's theory to a test there of falsehood or truth, and we saw what we saw. Eli in Portland, Maine, thank you for calling, Eli. You're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for the time. I wanted to mention that despite the perspectives about certain ancient civilizations, some of them did know enough about astronomy to predict when eclipses were happening. Groups like the Mayans, the ancient Greeks, the Egyptians, and the wisdom traditions and religious orders from these groups would sometimes use the secret knowledge to manipulate their civilizations. They would say, well, we need two cows instead of one cow sacrificed to us because, and if you don't, we'll make the sky dark.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, get out of here. And they're like, don't look, see what happened. And they're like, oh my God. So,
yes.
Sometimes religiously, sometimes cynically, but they would often do it. And it was a secret knowledge that they would keep from the common people.
We'll look at examples of that. I'm really glad you raised that. I've got a little clip here. Mark Twain knew that well. He used it in his novel, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Of course, you've got this time-traveling main character, Hank. He's sentenced to death on a day that happens to coincide with a historic solar eclipse. Hank knows that. He's time-traveling. He tells King Arthur that he will blot out the sun, this Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, if he's executed. And once the eclipse arrives, in Twain's imagination, he uses it to his advantage, secures his release, and becomes the second most powerful person in the kingdom. Here's that scene from the 1978 PBS adaptation of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Name any terms you will, even to the halving of my kingdom. But banish this calamity. Spare the sun.
By my labors, you shall become the mightiest monarch on earth, and England the richest, most prosperous country. Now, you get all this, plus the sun back, for, let's say, 1% of the gross and no taxes.
No taxes?
No taxes?
Agreed.
Mark Twain having fun with his clever Yankee in King Arthur's court there, knowing that the eclipse is coming and using it to his advantage. John, what about the history of manipulating societies through knowledge of a coming eclipse?
Yes, the most famous example is Christopher Columbus. It's 1504. He's on his fourth voyage to the New World. His ship is damaged by worms and won't float anymore. So he beaches it in Jamaica, and he tells the rest of the fleet to go off and find a rescue for him. And months go by, and the Jamaicans get tired of Columbus and his constant demand for food.
Mm-hmm.
And so Columbus finally tells them, Columbus happens to have an almanac. He sees there's going to be a total lunar eclipse. He tells them he's going to make the full moon go dark. And that actually happens. And as a result, he didn't have any more trouble getting any food from the Jamaicans.
Is this a verified or is this also from the realm of myth, John?
Oh, no, that's a verified.
Wow.
That's what happened in 1504.
Pretty straight up use of little astronomical knowledge there. Of course, it goes back to the Bible as well. The Bible describes this great darkness falling for 3 hours, beginning at noon. During the crucifixion of Jesus, here's country singer Johnny Cash reading from chapter 15 of the Gospel of Mark.
Now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, Lama Sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Astronomer John Dvorak, does it line up with the historical record of eclipse?
Almost. There is a lunar eclipse that happens on April 3 in the year 33. And many people think that is the time of the crucifixion. But in the modern theory of the motion of the moon, there's a slight problem. In Jerusalem, that lunar eclipse happened before the moon rose. And so there's been this debate. It's gone on ever since the time of Newton, of trying to use the timing of a lunar eclipse to date this event. And that's where we stand right now.
Frank, you must be one of the greatest eclipse watchers on Earth at this point. How will you watch there in Wyoming on Monday? How will you situate yourself?
Well, with awe, but I just wanted to add something to what John was saying, because he's mentioning the lunar eclipse on the night of the crucifixion. Of course, the crucifixion took place at Passover, which is the time of the full moon. So whatever may or may not have happened, you couldn't have had an eclipse of the sun at that time, but you could have had an eclipse of the moon. Mm. And as he said, on the 3rd of April, 33 AD, there was an eclipse of the moon. One thing that has always intrigued me, and I hope some biblical scholars out there might be able to help on this, there was a total eclipse of the sun visible in Jerusalem in November 29 AD, just 3.5 years beforehand. Now, that is at the time when Christ is beginning his ministry. There's no mention of this whatsoever in the Bible. And I'm wondering whether the Gospels, which are written 70 or 80 years later, the memory of that 29 AD solar eclipse was so vivid, combined with possibly the lunar eclipse of 33, that these were conflated together in the memories of the writers. And it may well be that that has something to do with the whole story.
I think we're going to leave it right there for today and leave our listeners with plenty of wonder and stories to contemplate as the eclipse comes to the continental USA. Frank Close has chased so many. He'll be watching from Jackson, Wyoming on Monday. His book is Eclipse, Journeys to the Dark Side of the Moon. Thanks so much for being with us, Frank.
Thank you.
And John Dvorak, author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. He'll be watching from Oregon. John, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Be safe, everyone. If you watch, watch carefully. Pay attention. Pink Floyd with Eclipse right here. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.